855 right now and make a pledge. You can also do it online if you like. And this time around, we have a new web address for pledging that's a little bit easier to remember. Jack Brighton has developed this. It's willpledge.org. So you can do it that way, either way. And as a special incentive this morning, we're doing the show that we call We Love the Book Show. I don't know. We don't have a fancy name for it.
I like See, that. That's good. That's good. We love the books.
Among
show.
The things we like on this program are books and writers and librarians. We really love librarians.
Don't forget the librarians.
And we have all of the above with us here this morning. Philip Graham is here and also Kelly Strom. Philip is a writer. He also teaches English here at University of Illinois in the creative writing program. Mm-hmm. And Kelly is the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. And between the two of them, they have brought books to recommend. And when we do this show, that's what we do. We try to give you some suggestions, something that you might not be aware of, things that are new and interesting. And I know over the years I've benefited, and I am sure that people listening have too, benefited from the suggestions that the guests have made. And as an incentive to get people to pledge this morning, we're doing this thing that we call Crazy Dave and Jack's, and also Harriet and Martha's, Big Book Giveaway. Now you're saying to yourself, Dave, what's this all about? Well, let me tell you, anybody who will call in and make a pledge this morning at the $40 level, the basic level, or more, we will send you a book. We get many of them here. Publishers send us the books, hoping that we will interview the authors. And we do many of them, but there are far more books than we can do. We just don't have the hours in the day. And they are good books. They are brand new. Almost all of them are hardcover. And we like to find good homes for them. So if people will call in and make that pledge, and I think what we've done in the past is if we said you can choose either fiction or nonfiction. We can't go into greater detail than that. But we'll send you a novel, or we'll send you something nonfiction. Could be history, could be biography, could be something about science. We'll pick, and we'll do our best to get something good for you. So, and we've done this in the past. People get really jazzed about this, and it's a good way we can get people to support the station. So,
it's good for the books.
And it's good for the books, too.
In that book kennel pen you have in the back, you know, they rustle their pages forlornly.
They
need
sad.
A home.
They you go in there, yeah. and they just look at you with yeah. those big eyes, and it's just very difficult.
Yes.
So we want to find homes for these books. 244-9455 is the number to call and make a pledge. Have we started yet? Oh, yes, I think we have.
We're waiting.
Thank you both very much for being here. We really appreciate it. Philip has been here many times, and Kelly, this is your second visit, and
we're right.
really glad that you could be here again.
Thank you for inviting me.
And what we do here is, as I said, the guests just come and they bring books, bring big tote bags full of books to recommend. So why don't we have Kelly start? Tell me about now. Here, already we have a controversy. Already,
I don't know if I want to, because Professor Graham says that this is not a good book.
It's a disappointingly incomplete book. It should be actually 1,002 natural wonders,
yeah. and it's a big book too.
It's huge.
It's not a small book. Well,
it's a doorstop
with the qualification that Philip says it's imperfect.
It's missing something. At least one crucial sight.
Tell us about it.
It's called 1,001 Natural Wonders You Must See Before You Die. Which
must we bring that?
A little morbid.
That's right. That mortality thing just turns me off to the whole.
We felt that perhaps instead it should be that you should visit.
Yeah.
Without a time frame on it.
Okay. Well, setting that aside,
Philip says that there's something missing.
Well, yeah, the Azores, and in particular the island of São Miguel, and in particular the 7 mile in diameter volcanic caldera Sete Cidades with 4 lakes. 2 large pastures and a town in it is not in that book, and that's a great disappointment.
Yeah.
Well, see, I'm sure that there are people who are listening would say, I would like to add something to the list.
Yeah,
so we
exactly.
probably pretty soon
yeah.
we could get 2,001.
That's probably the sequel.
Okay, but if just to get you started, here's 1,000 places you can go.
Well, that's true. That's just to get started. The author, Michael Bright, he's an executive producer with BBC's Natural History Unit, and he has written over 75 natural history books, and there are some beautiful pictures in here. I've kind of highlighted a couple things that I thought I'd point out. For those of you wondering, what in the Midwest must you see? Really, there's no Midwest entries.
Oh, it's a good book. Now I changed my mind.
You Easterners.
The closest you get is Tennessee.
Well, that's sort of in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Okay. It's something called the Lost Sea in Tennessee, which I've been through Tennessee many, many a time, and I can't say that I've ever seen the lost.
Is it because it's lost?
It's lost. I could never find it.
What is the lost sea?
It's the largest underground lake in the United States.
Wow.
It lies deep within a cave system in the mountains of East Tennessee.
And this is a place that you can go on a tour of?
Yes. The actual caverns have provided shelter and secrecy for a number of people. The Cherokee used to inhabit a cave called the Council Room and left behind a wide range of artifacts. Soldiers stored ammunition here in the Civil War. And during Prohibition, one of the caverns was used as a speakeasy.
Cool.
So I'm checking that place out my next vacation.
Sounds good.
So that was the closest thing I could get to the Midwest. And then I thought I'd point out a couple other U.S. things because there's most of the book, of course, is non-U.S. sites. So I just thought I'd point out a couple.
Are you sure like Shelbyville isn't in there?
No. See, so it should be 103. Now we've got Portugal, Lake Shelbyville.
I'm going to call the people at the Illinois Department of Tourism, and I'm going to give them your name and phone number, and you're just going to have to answer them.
Illinois is very nice, but it's not as pretty as it could be.
Well, okay.
I did want to mention there is in here Devil's Tower in Wyoming, which, of course, was featured in Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah.
So that was kind of exciting. And there's a beautiful photograph here of Antelope Canyon in Arizona that's just stunning with the sunlight coming through a small slit in the canyon. And there's a description of that. I was thinking, actually, as I was going through this, I was telling Harriet out there that I think maybe I might put this on my Christmas list and use it kind of as a guide for where I'd like to go, what I'd like to visit, and then check them off.
So, and then you just strategically open it to one place and just leave it outside.
Yeah. Belize, Barrier Reef, there we go. Mm-hmm. Sign me up for that one. And here it is. There's another one here that I wanted to point out. The Bay of Mont-Saint-Michel in France is one that I actually have been to. So there were a couple that I was able to cross off the list already. Mount Haleakala.
You only have a mere 987 to go or something, right? Yeah.
Yes.
So this would be a great book if you have done some traveling, but you'd like to go to some places that are particularly striking. You could just spend the winter flipping through there. And
you know, kind of an armchair travel thing. Yeah, you know, if you're kind of a travel dreamer like I am, then I think this is a magnificent thing to look at just to kind of dream about all the places you'd love to go.
And again, what's the title of the book?
1001 Places, Natural Wonders You Must See Before You
Check Out. Okay. And I should mention that we will have the titles. We'll have the titles of all the books that we talked about this morning and the authors on our website.
Yes.
So that so people do not need to be trying madly to write them down as we do it. And if you don't have internet access, we could send you a list, but the easiest way to do is to go to wyll.uiuc.edu and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Well, now, Professor Graham.
Not Philip.
No, you better show us a really good one now.
Yeah, better be good now.
Okay, well, I'll try. This is a mislabeled book, I think. It's called Quake. It's written by the writer Nance Van Winkle. And it's billed as stories. And in fact, they are stories, but it really is a novel in stories. And it's a book that's structured in a way that I really have never seen any book structured before. It's a beautiful book. I'm going to get to that point a little bit later. But first, I want to do a little bit of reading from this. One of the wonderful things about this book is that everybody in this book has a very interesting job or history. There's a woman who... Oh, she lost both her hands from a lightning strike, and she has these hooks, and she makes her living playing the electric piano from one woman's organization across the country to another. And it sounds horrible, but it's a really sweet story. And then there's another guy who's a ventriloquist with a dummy named Rasputin, and then another fellow who has a job taking horror movies along the back roads of Mexico and showing them to villagers who've never seen a movie before. And in this one particular story, he's showing them Dracula, which completely freaks them out, and word spreads all over the other towns, don't let them take the movie into your town, and so forth. So there's just wonderful imagination. I'm going to read from the chapter about the guy who is a ventriloquist, and he has a dummy named Rasputin that his father made for him. Rasputin's long face, carved by my father, had a deep loneliness chiseled in its jaw. His eyes, rolled open, made him appear on the edge of lunacy. So the name Rasputin had, I suppose, just stuck, and no doubt partly determined how my ventriloquist voice was to be from then on. With a name like that, the doll had to pontificate in a spooky tone. He had to say things only a wild, eccentric monk would say, which, as I figured, could be anything. As part of my routine, I'd feign fear of the doll, my own dummy, letting out startled responses with slight squeaks around the syllables, which is how I came by my name, Squeaky Fritz. I'd have Rasputin taunt and tease total strangers in the audience until they'd raise a fist. Maybe they'd throw popcorn or wadded-up tickets. "Ball!" he'd shout to a lady with a baby in row one. "That kid don't look a thing like the man you're with." This might make the husband stand up and take a step into the aisle. Then I'd cross myself. I'd look up to the ceiling. "Holy Mother," I'd say, or, "Take me, Heavenly Father, take me quick." The few times Rasputin made people mad enough to storm up on the stage, they'd go for him, not me. They'd grab him off my hand by his cloth neck and shake him. Then, in a gesture of surprise, they'd fling him to the floor. He weighed nothing. He was nothing. Such were the highlights of my show. I'd stand up, put my hands over my face, and send the Rasputin voice far off. Distant voice throwing was my claim to fame. Although he lay on the floor, I made him laugh in a high, shrill cackle from the rafters. I made him deliver a crow-like cawing from the blue spotlight. "Oh, I'm dead. I'm dead. I'm a soul without its body. You'll be seeing me all for the rest of your days." And Squeaky Fritz loses Rasputin at one point in the story, and he's trying to get him back, and he finds himself actually kind of in actually this way. He first of all, it's a bad situation. He's got some jobs he has to do. So he says, "I bought a tiny Tears doll at Woolworth's just to get me through the two engagements I had booked in Boise, but no infant in the arms ever spoke such crudities. I was booed. I was pelted with peanuts." Anyway, so he really wants to get this this ventriloquist dummy back, and he finds himself meeting up with a family of gypsies, and he's attracted to the younger woman in the family, and he really is more attracted to her than he really wants to, you know, than he believes that she's going to help him find it, and she wants him to kill a rooster and bring it to her, and he won't do that, so he gets a frozen duck at the local supermarket and thaws it out and brings it. And so she's trying to do a divination with this, and the two older women come from behind a curtain, and he doesn't like them being there. The girl and I sat quietly while all this went on, the women's long full skirts fanning us with a breeze. "Give me that hand," Marissa said, and I didn't even pause to think about it. I laid my fist on the table. She opened my fingers like pieces of husk around a seed. "So, this wooden man you want back?" She had my palm spread in front of her. Her one finger stroking the lines in my hand felt warm and soft and dangerous. I made the palm answer for itself. "A man of God is lost," the palm said in the crazy monk's voice. Then I shook my wrist as if it were vibrating to some secret vocal cords inside it. She stared at me. "Do that again." "Do what?" "Speak down there." She looked at my hand. "No!" I let that word with my mouth fully and flatly closed let go. I sent the sound down to my fingertips and wiggled them. She jumped back in her chair. She looked from the hand to my face. "What? What does my palm say?" I asked in my real voice with my real mouth. "Can you see my future? Will what's lost be returned to me?" I pushed my hand toward her and she eyed it suspiciously. "Help me," it said in a slow, eerie drone. She stood up, her hands over her face, her lovely breast jostling in the blue blouse. Then she rapped on the table. "Go," she said. "Something evil is with you. That's what I see." The two older women stepped suddenly into the room, one with her cane still raised from the way she'd just parted the curtains with. The blonde was still carrying the duck by one of its drumstick legs. "What?" the one with the cane said, looking not at the girl but at me. "What? What?" "Do not fear this stupid man," I sailed the voice, letting my held breath out slowly into the gaping hole of the duck's neck. We all of us looked at it. The woman who held it raised it toward her face and peered at it. "Ay, he's lost me, that fool, the fool," the bird cackled. The blonde woman shook it like a big bug from her hand, and it flew into the wall, knocking a framed picture of the Virgin Mary to the floor. Gold beads that had hung from the corners of the frame went flying. Then the cane was coming at me. The woman who'd thrown the bird was crying. The girl was screaming. And in my rush toward the door, I tripped over one chair, then another, all the while sending my voice behind me into the bird carcass on the floor. Oh, I'm killed! I'm killed again! Help me, Holy Mother of God! Help me!
This is why we like to have Philip come to be on the show, because he finds things that are slightly off the beaten path.
Well, come on. Anyway, the thing that's really unusual about this book, though, that's off the beaten path, is that this is really – there's a stories that are all interconnected, and so they become a kind of novel. But usually when you have interconnected stories, you have a character in one appearing in another, and that builds a relationship, so forth. Mm-hmm. None of the characters in any of these stories know that they're connected to the other characters mm-hmm. in the other stories. And even some of the objects, like an organ, will get sold, and you'll see it later in a pawn shop, and no one will know where it came from except you, mm-hmm. the reader. And when other people pass each other by or have conversations or talk about certain things, you know what the interconnections are, but they don't. And so, you know, and if you think about that, that happens a lot in life, where we will pass by people who maybe we knew in our childhood, but we don't know anymore that that kid was in our kindergarten class or something like this, those kinds of things. And the wonderful thing is that after a certain point, you know, Nance Van Winkle puts you in this sort of godlike position of knowing how all the strands are held together that none of the characters themselves know about. It's beautifully structured. I've never read a book like it before.
And again, it is?
Quake, Q-U-A-K-E, as in, you know, earthquake. Nance Van Winkle.
All right. I'm told Harriet Williamson says that Philip's list of books are already on the website, and Martha is working on putting the ones that Kelly brought. So they will be there, WILL.UIUC.EDU, and go to probably should have to go to Focus 580, and the information is there. Otherwise, we send it to you. Here on Focus in this hour, in fact, both hours, we're talking about new books, and maybe not necessarily new, but we have two guests who have books to recommend, and we hope that maybe one or two of these things will appeal to you. So you'll go to the bookstore, you'll go to the library, you will pick them up. And if you are listening this morning and maybe you also have something you'd like to recommend, perhaps something you've read recently you thought was particularly good, you can get in on the show too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You want to take another turn, Kelly?
Sure. I brought one here that I picked up a while back because I was a big Nancy Drew reader when I was little. Hmm. And so then I saw this one called Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. And I thought, well, what is that about? And it's actually in the teen section. But to tell you the truth, I don't think many teens these days would really get it. Mm-hmm. I think it's more geared towards women who were big Nancy Drew fans when they were young. And it's actually a parody. It's fiction. And it's a parody written by Chelsea Kane. And the idea of the story is that this is Nancy Drew grown up. And she has a beef with the whole Nancy Drew series because she says that her story was stolen from her college roommate, who stole her diaries, made up the Nancy Drew stories, and sold them on her own. And she made up a lot of things in the stories that aren't necessarily true, and so she feels that her identity is being being ripped off by this college roommate. And part of it is when she's dating the Hardy Boys. So...
Really?
Yes.
Did Nancy Drew date the Hardy Boys, or that was just
in real life? Apparently, she did. That's part of
the
deal here.
The line between truth and fiction.
The things we didn't know. Apparently, Nancy Drew was quite a hottie, and so
was Tom Swift in the equation anywhere at all?
He did not.
Wouldn't he have been the previous generation? Tom Swift was the Hardy. Wasn't he the Hardy Boys' grandfather or something?
Could possibly.
Okay. I have a little part to read here. She's just met up with the Hardy Boys again, and they have been sabotaged and tied up in a room by bad guys. And this is her description of, and the whole book is written like the way the Nancy Drew books were written, and it's kind of, those of you who aren't familiar with it maybe wouldn't get it, but you know, she'll like swing her Titian hair behind her and determine the right type of pumps that she needs to wear to this outing. So here's part of it. It was a full hour later when I noticed the ventilator duct above our heads. Frank, that would be Frank Hardy, I exclaimed, adjusting my blouse. Look at that. Lift me up and I bet I'll be able to climb out and open the door. Frank lifted me by my hips and I was able to reach up to the vent, remove the grate, and pull myself into the small square duct. I shimmied several feet and found myself at another vent that exited into the kitchen of the Green Jade Cafe. After ascertaining that the coast was clear, I carefully lowered myself to the floor and, retracing my route through the duct, found the pantry where Frank and I had been held captive. The key was in the lock. Within moments, Frank was free, and we set out to find the others. We found them tied to chairs in a back room behind the kitchen. They were dressed in striped shirts and wool pants, the sailor outfits of the day. Their captors, two mustachioed gentlemen with tattooed forearms and large gold hoop earrings in one ear, hovered over them scowling. "Gypsy pirates," I mouthed to Frank. Joe and Ned were being shanghaied. Without thought to my own personal safety, I rushed in and karate chopped one of the pirates firmly across the back of the neck. He fell to the ground with a thud. Frank, a few steps behind me, socked the other pirate across the jaw. The pirate stumbled for a moment and then also fell to the floor unconscious. Frank and I quickly untied the boys. "Oh, Ned," you know, which was her boyfriend actually in the Nancy Drew books. See, but Ned doesn't realize she had a thing going with the Hardy Boys. "Oh, Ned," I cried, throwing my arms around him. "They were going to sell us to a riverboat captain," cried Joe. "He was going to take us to New Orleans and then send us on a ship to the Orient. I came here to get a drink after Helen Corning stood me up, and the next thing I knew, I was in that closet where you found me." It's just a small
and it goes, it sounds like it's a hoot.
It's actually, it's hysterical. I giggled the whole time I was reading this book, and I couldn't explain to people what was so funny because they weren't Nancy Drew readers and they didn't get it.
Yeah.
But I highly recommend this very amusing book, Confessions of a Teen Sleuth. All right. A parody by Chelsea Kane.
Well, right here, what I want to do is take some time to see if we can move some books. Now, as I explained at the beginning of the program, on Focus 580 in the afternoon magazine both, we get tons and tons of books from publishers. They send them to us hoping that we'll interview the authors, and many times we do. And sometimes we get them at the rate of 5 or 6 or 8 every day in the mail. It's wonderful for us because we get to peruse them all. We get to read them. We get to pass them out to our friends. And we do accumulate them and have big piles of them for just a time like this when we're trying to encourage people to support this radio station with their financial contributions. So here's what we're saying this morning. If you will call in and make a pledge at the $40 level or above, we will send you, with our thanks, a book, something that's new. They are hardcover books, newly published. And the thing that we're saying is, will you just tell us whether you would like to have fiction or nonfiction? We can't really do much better than that, because if we do what we usually do, which means we might get 20 or 30 or more pledges, it gets kind of hard to individually tailor the selections to the person. So the best we can do is say fiction, nonfiction, but we promise it'll be something good. And if you give us a call at 244-9455, make a pledge, we'll send you a book with our thanks. And $40 would be good. If you can do more, well, that would be great. Jack Brighton is here. He's
Hello.
Our web guy. He is an occasional substitute host of Focus 580 and the man we call the producer emeritus. A Focus 580, because he did that job for a long, long time.
That's right.
And so now, how are we going to get people jazzed about this?
Well, I see one line lit up. Let's check with David Teal, who's our TV program director. He's in our pledge center. He's contributing his time to this effort this morning to get you to call 217-244-9455. How's it going, Dave?
Well, it's going fine. Now, that call, though, that you saw, that was the phone that was lit up there,
don't tell me.
That was an FM call.
Yeah.
It was for the sister station. But we did hear from Elizabeth Bieberman of Champaign, who has claimed a nonfiction book. And we hope you will join her in claiming, well, your choice, fiction, nonfiction. I want the one about the Gypsy Pirates, personally. I indeed not only read Hardy Boys books growing up, but a good bit of Nancy Drew as well. So I remember the Titian hair and all of that, and the roadster. In fact, I'm going to have to, I think, find that book you were talking about. So if you're a pirate, a gypsy, or a gypsy pirate, give us a call right now at 217-244-9455. Make a pledge at the $40 level. You can claim your choice of books. You can also pledge via the website, which Jack, of course, runs for us, and that's willpledge.org. We've set that up specifically for pledges, so you can dial that up on the internet if you're listening to us and you know, doing your internet thing at the same time.
That's right. And please help us get rid of some books here. Now, we love books, okay? Don't get me wrong, but we are lousy with books. We have so many darn books. They send them to us, the publishers, because they want us to interview the authors. So we have all these great books just sitting around waiting for you to claim one with your pledge, basic membership level of $40 or $25 if you're a student or a senior citizen, 217-244-9455, and you can pick either fiction or nonfiction. And, you know, one thing we know, Dave, I think, from doing this show, is that books contain ideas, and ideas are dangerous.
We've said that many times.
Absolutely.
We've warned people, haven't we?
That's right.
Look, if you're going to read, you're going to be introduced to ideas. It could cause confusion. It might broaden
your perspective,
I hate to have your perspective broadened.
That's hard because that, you know, that kind of, you know, well, anyway.
Just so, with that kind of warning.
Yeah, but okay. we do think that a little danger is good. So please help keep us dangerous. Keep this this show going, this operation going that gives you all these access to all these great ideas. Author interviews, et cetera, and we're giving away books. 217-244-9455.
We're just trying to get people excited. Go to the telephone, make a call, make a pledge. We'll send you a book. Okay. We will talk again with Jack and Dave near the end of the hour. And for both hours here this morning, Philip Graham, Kelly Strom will be sharing some books with us. Philip teaches at the U of I, and he's a professor of English. And Kelly is the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. I think, Philip, it would be your turn to go next.
All right. Maybe a little change of pace here. This is a book by the author Rebecca Brown, who's a wonderful fiction writer. But this is a nonfiction book. And it's called Excerpts from a Family Medical Diary. And it's about the death of her mother from cancer. And it's already, you know, we were making fun of the Before You Die part of the other book. It seems like a book you perhaps wouldn't want to read because it seems like it would be very depressing. And it is at times filled with hard information. But it's a beautiful book. And it's a beautiful book that's a testimony for a daughter's love for her mother and, in fact, a family's love for a woman who is passing away. This is from the chapter called Hydrotherapy. My mother used to take long hot baths. She'd go in the bathroom with a paperback and close the door and sit in the tub for what seemed like hours and read what she called her bathtub books, Mysteries by Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Tony Hillerman. She didn't like the violent ones or the ones with sex. She liked a good read with quirky characters and colorful settings where you'd learn something about English village life between the wars, Aztec history, Flemish food, or Navajo spirituality. She called this her hydrotherapy. She always knew the end before it happened. When she got out of the tub, her skin looked pink and soft, even if it was early, like 7 o'clock. She'd get into her bathrobe and sit down and watch TV with me or clip and file her fingernails or read or talk to me. One time when my sister, who was an art history major, came home from college, I took a picture of her sitting on the toilet, her head on her in her hands like Rodin's Thinker, and Mom in the tub beside her reading a mystery novel. They knew I was taking the picture, and they tried not to laugh. We all thought it was hysterical. My brother was away at college, too, and I was still in high school. I was living alone with my mother in a studio apartment. My mother's hair is long in the picture, dark and full. When it became hard for my mother to bathe herself, I helped her. At first I sat in the bathroom with her. I sat on the floor and washed her back and thinning hair, and I helped her get in and out of the tub, and I dried her. Her hair was falling out, and her skin was becoming so loose from the weight she was losing. Along her arms where they had drawn her blood and put in the chemo or bruises. They were purple and yellow when they got old, but blue and dark when they were new. At first I would help her get in and out. She would hold on to my arm and the side of the tub and lower herself in slowly, and I would help her. One time I offered to read to her in the tub, but she said not to. Her reading in the tub when we were kids was as much about getting away from us as it was about reading. Now she was glad to have us, the children who'd moved away from her, around her. I'm grateful you're here, she said to me. Once she said, "I feel sorry for people who don't have daughters." Sometimes we sat and said nothing at all. She sat and soaked and put in more hot water when the temperature cooled and swirled it in around her. We brought her bubble bath and oils and mineral salts. We got her sea sponges and a blow-up terry cloth pillow to lie back on. When she was finished, I'd help her stand and step from the tub and dry her and help her put her nightie on. Later, there was the porta-cath that you had to be very careful around. You had to keep it dry and clean. Then later, when she was no longer able to get up if she sat down, we got her a bath seat and installed a movable shower head. Finally, we washed her with sponges in bed. We would remove her wet diaper and wipe her with a baby wipe and put on a clean one. We would clean her skin and put lotion on. Some of the time she looked at us, but most of the time her eyes were away or closed. Sometimes she would moan, and we would think she was trying to say something. Then this too stopped. And just a little short one, the night of the mother's death. The night my mother died, my sister came into our room and said, "Chris?" And Chris and I shot out of bed. I went to my mother's room and touched her face and her pulse, and I saw her face, and I said to my mother and Chris, "She's dead." Chris touched my mother and said she was dead. I don't remember what I did. Did I cry out loud or say something? Did I lean over my mother and kiss her? I don't remember. I remember my sister getting onto the bed and holding my mother and crying and saying, "Mama." When she got up, Chris lay beside my mother too and held her and thanked my mother out loud for loving her. I remember my sister, either with something she said or a gesture, asking, "Did I want to lie with my mother and hold her goodbye?" But I couldn't. Now, one thing I sort of want to add here is Chris, who thanks Rebecca's mother for loving her, is Rebecca Brown's partner. And the family values exhibited in this book are beautiful. Mm. And shame on those people out there who, in the name of family values, hate people who are different from them.
You know, it strikes me that it's a book, if you... Perhaps if you gave it to someone and you told them it was fiction, you could read it like a novel. Do you think that somehow the impact of the book is different because you know that this is someone telling you a true story, something that happened to them?
That's a giant question. You know, I mean, first it was funny that you said, you know, when you were talking before, you said you want fiction or nonfiction. You know, for me, I find that interesting because I think a lot of nonfiction is imagined, necessarily has to be, or reimagines the past in ways that isn't exactly truthful to the event. And how could that possibly be anyway? And at the same time, I think that fiction is filled with truth, even if it's completely made up, because you write out of your life. And you transpose what's happened to you onto the lives of your characters. So they are different, but I think they're profoundly similar at the same time.
Hmm. Yeah, very good. Well, we are a little bit past the midpoint here. And again, our guests, Philip Graham, he's a writer, and he also teaches creative writing here at the U of I. Kelly Strom is here, too. She's the collection manager from the Champaign Public Library. And both of them are interested in books and writing. And Philip is a great consumer of writing and books. Well, I'm sure Kelly is, too.
Consumer, the producer. Well,
personally and professionally, producer, yeah. Because I'm sure that she is a big reader. But then you're also – so in your job is to decide what new book the library will acquire?
Right. I'm in charge of selecting adult materials that includes the fiction, nonfiction, audiobooks, magazines, newspapers, Spanish, teen, and rock pop CDs.
I just have a tiny idea about how much is published every month, how many new titles. How do you ever decide? Because your budget obviously is limited, your shelf space is limited, so you've got to make some decisions about, I will choose these 10 books, and these 10 books, while they might be worthwhile, we're going to say, no, we're not going to go with those 10, we're going to go with these 10.
It's hard because it's very overwhelming. There is so much that's published. I rely on what I think our customers would enjoy at the library, and I try to go by what the library's mission statement is. You know, we are a popular materials library, and so I'm looking for what's going to be the big thing right now, where the trends are going. I look at, say, People magazine. I look and see what books they're talking about in People, as well as what books they're talking about, say, in the Ninth Letter that's mm-hmm. published here on campus.
Thank you for mentioning that.
You're welcome. Or, I try to get a broad spectrum, but I try to do it through means that other people will find out about it also, so that if they're reading the Ninth Letter, if they're reading People, or if they're reading Oprah's magazine and something's mentioned, I want to make sure that we have it at the library mm-hmm. just because that's our role.
Yeah. Who is this Oprah? No, never mind. She's back, isn't she? She has reconstituted her book club. Oh, yep. Philip, you should just see the look on a man's face.
Bless you, Oprah. Bless you. No, come on. I mean, you know, after that dope who dissed her a few years ago, you know, I can't remember his name. I'm so mad at him. Jonathan Franzen, you know, mm-hmm. and he blew it for all the living writers. And she started reading mm-hmm. dead people, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. come on, you know. I mean, no, it's great. Oprah's great. And she's just has increased the quality of literacy mm-hmm. in this country in profound ways.
If you got to give it to her and say, if she gets people to read, this is a good thing.
Absolutely.
But it's also just, you know, amazing when you think that somebody in that position can say, here's a good book, I like this, mm-hmm. and then you know that the next day
A million people
are going to go out and buy that book.
And it's a bestseller.
Yeah. And it's a bestseller.
The next day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about her, too, is she finds books by people who, for the most part, are not by writers who are already mm-hmm. not already known.
That's right.
And so that gives hope to a lot of writers like myself. I love you, Oprah. And and at the same time, you know, it introduces a whole new category of writers into mm-hmm. the sort of the public discourse. What she's done is extraordinary, and I hope she keeps doing it for years to come.
All right.
Absolutely.
Hear, hear, Oprah. Okay. Well, now that we've bowed to Oprah.
Deep sincerity. I mean, really. I mean, writers love her. We love her. You know.
No, but I mean, I think what we said
Franzen.
Was except for Jonathan. What we said was, I mean, absolutely true. Yes. Mm-hmm. If anybody who will do something to encourage, in whatever way to encourage people to read books, we have to say, this is a good thing.
That's right.
This is a good thing. Mm-hmm. All right, Kelly, your turn.
Yes. Well, I'm taking a little different tact from Philip's last book.
Well, we don't want everybody to cry.
I know. I'm thinking I can't go on after that. But I did bring one here called Confessions of a Slacker Wife. And it's written by the same woman who wrote Confessions of a Slacker Mom, which was a bestseller that I picked up first and loved. I picked up just because I thought, what a funny title. Mm-hmm. And I started reading it, and she started the book talking about, you know, I'm driving my kids to their, you know, 15 different organized sports and activities. And then she comes to the realization, why am I doing this? Why can't they just go play in the dirt like I did when I was a kid? You know, and why am I cleaning everything with antibacterial soap? My goodness, I ate bugs, you know? Uh-huh. No, really. And she goes on and on about that.
You're bringing back my childhood.
And I'm thinking, gosh darn it, she's right. You know, that sounds perfect. You know, I want my kids to be able to go outside and play. I don't want to drive them to ballet all the time or, you know, all the other activities. So I loved that book. So when she came out with this one, I picked this one up as well. And this is the one that happened to be on the shelf today at the library, Confessions of a Slacker Wife. And the author's name is Muffy, and then a hyphenated last name, Mead Farrow. Mead is M-E-A-D, Farrow, F-E-R-R-O. And she comes from a family that raised cattle out west in Wyoming. And she's just come to the realization that what are we doing to our kids? What are we doing, you know, to ourselves? And so this Confessions of a Slacker Wife, it's slim, it's very amusing, and I have a little part here that I wanted to read you. I'm sure that, like me, you've heard about the alarming loss of self-esteem that often occurs among teen girls who are constantly bombarded with media images of impossibly beautiful and absurdly thin young women. These images have the potential to create both mental and physical health problems for young girls, the reports say, because for the vast majority of them, there is no amount of dieting, exercise, or thigh cream that would ever enable them to look like the female bodies they see in magazines and on TV. The problem, they say, is that for almost all teenage girls, the portrayals of womanhood presented by the mass media are just completely unrealistic. Excuse me, but for teenage girls? The supermodel standards are unrealistic for teenage girls? Are they just completely down to earth then for those of us who are over 30? I remember being pregnant one time and getting like a Victoria's Secret catalog in the mail, and I thought, you know, that's rude. That's just rude. I dare say that if the cover of Cosmo makes the average teenage girl feel inadequate, then it should be no surprise if it makes my 44-year-old women like myself want to hang ourselves from the rafters with a thong. Not that I would ever do such a thing, but I must congratulate myself on having come up with a functional purpose for a thong. The truth is, now that I'm in my mid-40s, I've discovered I don't have complete control over my body, despite what Shape magazine says, and I certainly have less control than I did in my teens. I don't just mean the startling bouts of incontinence that follow childbearing. I mean, I literally woke up one day to find a jiggly spare tire down my middle, with extra padding on both sides of my lower back, and I swear I've done absolutely nothing to bring upon this myself. In fact, I actually still do sit-ups. I've never eaten a box of Krispy Kremes. I've never been a couch potato. I simply arrived at my mid-40s exactly on schedule, and my body at this point started acquiring peculiar characteristics completely of its own accord, and quite suddenly, I might add. So I thought that was telltale. Being 40 myself, I can relate to that. All of a sudden, it's bam. And then here's another one about having a group come over to her house. You know, many of us are involved in book clubs or other social groups, and we have people come over to our house. And, you know, you go to great lengths to fix the best appetizers or have the best floral arrangements there just to look nice for your group. And one chapter, she's discussing this thing. What am I thinking? That's wearing me out. How can I enjoy the day when I've driven myself crazy trying to get all this ready for my group? Mm. So this is a little bit about that. About a year ago, I was assigned hostess for a committee meeting of about 20 other women, and I find myself, a few hours before they arrive for drinks and hors d'oeuvres, making a serious attempt to sponge the dirt from the word on at the top of an old toggle light switch in our powder room. This was a feat I had to perform in near darkness for obvious reasons. But what I remember with utter clarity is the following. It was very difficult to get inside the letter O clean. I'm sure at least some of the grime was 70 years old and it was stuck inside the infernal little circle like black glue. I finally ended up with a wire brush dipped in ammonia that actually did the trick. But in my moment of triumph, it occurred to me that I stood some chance of being electrocuted while performing this lunatic bit of cleaning I'd somehow worked myself into. I swear that all I'd set out to do some 20 minutes before was to spiff up the bathroom so I could have some people over and not leave the impression that my house was unkempt. I slapped myself, figuratively, of course, and sat down on the potty, exhausted. The amount of work I'd gone to just to make things nice for these women, friends, most of them, and non-judgmental, all of them, was laughable. At least I realized that much at that moment. I also realized that I was so totally drained for what I really wanted to do was go upstairs and lie back on my bed with a nice cup of tea and watch an episode of Law and Order, not socialize with 20 other women. Not for the first time, I was too tired and too stressed out to have a good time at my own get-together. Mm. And she goes on to say, you know what? When my husband has friends over, they pull out a bag of chips. Why can't I just pull out a bag of chips? You know, and then I'm doing a disservice to the next mom or wife who's having this get together because then she thinks she has to do it really nice
standard.
Because
yeah.
I did. And I'm doing everybody a favor if I just pull out a bag of chips. I'm kind of digging that. I'm all about pulling out a bag of chips.
Okay. Confessions of a Slacker Wife. Very good. And again, go to our website, wyll.uiuc.edu, and we'll get you the titles of all the books that we talked about here this morning and the authors. We have a caller here, someone who'd like to get in on the conversation. Before we find ourselves out of time in the first hour, I want to make sure we talk with them. Someone in Urbana, and it's line one right here. Hello.
Our book group is meeting tonight, and I guess I'll just bring a bag of chips.
Yay!
Good plan.
I was going to make rosemary walnuts and something with lavender, but I think I won't. I'll just bring some lavender and rosemary for people to smell.
And just tell them you're doing them a favor.
Yeah. The book we read last month was Jane Eyre, and usually we read contemporary authors. I'm not sure if I ever read Jane Eyre in high school, but it was a revelation to read it now. Mm-hmm. And once in a while, it's nice to go back and mm-hmm. read something that you may or may not have read years ago that you were supposed to have read, one of the classics, and look at it with fresh eyes. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to pass along that possibility to people.
That's a great idea.
And I find that your impression of the book, of course, changes considerably. Even if you had read it in high school, that's nothing like reading it later on in life.
You're an adult. You
absolutely.
My wife is an anthropologist, and the people that she has studied for many years, they don't conjugate verbs, they conjugate pronouns. So instead of a past, present, or future run or walk or eat, it's a past, present, and future I or we or they. And it makes a lot more sense when you think about it. You know, the action, why does that change in time? It's the person that, who initiates the action who changes in time. It's actually much closer to reality. And yes, when you read a book in high school because it's a great book, often those great books aren't—you're not ready for those great books. When you're older, you go, oh, my God, this is wonderful, you know. And I've done that a few times, and it's always a great, great pleasure.
I'm enjoying the discussion. Take care. Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Is there something that just comes to mind as one of those kinds of things, one of those classics, the things that we maybe had felt we had to slog through when we were in high school that as an adult you came back to and you read and you thought, this is a great book.
You slogged through it probably because it was way over your head. You know, you couldn't possibly, as a 15 or 16 or 17-year-old, understand the depths of what a great book might be. Though it's I guess it's good to give it a try, but you should always go back.
They just don't have the life experiences to really be able to appreciate what the author was trying
to say. In many ways.
Okay. We have a couple of minutes here. I'm a little hesitant to have you one.
I can read a poem.
Okay, yes, do that. Read a poem.
I'm going to read a poem by one of my new colleagues in town, Tayemba Jess. He's a poet. He won the National Poetry Series competition for his first book called Lead Belly. And it's a book of poems all about the life of the blues singer Lead Belly. And I was going to read three, but because we have a short bit of time, I'll just read perhaps this one, which is beautiful. It's one of the first poems. It says, Sally Leadbetter, a Mother's Hymn, and it's a poem in the voice of Lead Belly's mother. When the black boy climbs out of my womb, how to peel dynamite from his bones, how to strip tornadoes' hum from his ears, how to weed graveyard from his garden of tongue, what rainbow of prayer to pull between teeth, how to blind him from liquor's sun of stupor, how to sow whisper into his hurricane of hips, what blizzard of plea to freeze his tremor of feet, how to lift him from streetlight blaze, which revengeful breast fed him this poison, which breast gilded his mouth with song.
Very nice.
It's a beautiful book.
It's
a beautiful book.
Well, perhaps in the next hour we'll give you a chance if you would like to read more from the book.
Yeah.
We're coming down to the end of the first hour, but never fear, we'll have more from Philip and Kelly to talk about more of their book recommendations. If there are people who are listening, want to call in, you can recommend something as well, as the last caller did. So we'll have plenty of time, and we'll have some more fun here in the next part of the show. We'll take a break here in just a second, but we also want to find some good homes for good books. As we have explained, we get every day the person from the post office comes. There's a truck. It's just for us. It's a truck full of books. Really, we get sometimes five or six or eight every day. Some of them end up on the show. They're almost all very good, but we can't do them all. And sometimes we give them away to people who work here, and that makes us a lot of friends here in the building. But also here, what we do is we use them to encourage people to pledge. So here's the deal. $40 basic pledge, we'll send you a book. You can have your choice, either fiction or nonfiction. You can pledge more if you want, but that's what we're just asking is the basic pledge at $40. 244-9455, that's the number to call. Jack Brighton is here.
Hello. Yes, see, the fact is these books are a problem for us because the building specs really don't cover the amount of books that we've got in this place. So we hope you will help us solve this problem and also help us solve the problem of funding WILL's operations for the next year. And you can do that simply by becoming a friend of WILL with that basic membership pledge. Again, the phone number 217-244-9455. Now, folks, these are grade A books. These are not some cheesy, you know, sort of slapdash attempt at a book. These are prime, Focus 580 approved, first edition hardcover books from major publishers. So you know the drill by now, I hope. And if you haven't, then we'll keep talking.
Even
about
Oprah
it next
would
hour
approve.
Anyway. Yes. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Well, they're Dave approved.
You've got to help these guys heck with cull the herd, right?
That's right. Yeah, so I don't see any phones ringing at the moment. So let's do something about that. Let's get you to make a pledge. If you haven't done it, this is a good chance. Get a book, make a pledge, support this the station and this program. 217-244-9455. David Teal is our TV program director, and he loves books too.
I do, as a matter of fact, and certainly I've heard some good suggestions today, and I wanted to let folks know we've given away 5 books so far during this hour. We'd love to give away a few more before the top of the hour, so right now we'd love to hear from you, 217-244-9455. If you love books, give us a call, make a pledge at the $40 level, and you can pick a fiction or nonfiction book, and I can vouch for the number of books that arrive. It's just like there's always a stack of them down in the mailroom. Pretty much every day.
Mm. I think it's because the publishers realize that listeners to public radio also read lots of books.
That's right.
And, you know, that's generally true. And we certainly talk a lot about books. We interview a lot of authors. A lot of the books that we're giving, in fact, might be authors that we've interviewed on the program.
Could well
so,
be.
Right.
That's the deal here, folks, that we're trying to get you excited about making a contribution to the station. We, throughout this week, we try to find as many different ways as we possibly can. And this is one that we can share with you some of the benefits of doing this show, the fact that we get all these books, and also encourage you to be a supporter of the station. It would be really great. And as Jack said, it's sort of a safety issue.
Exactly.
You know, the fire department comes here and they said, you got too much paper here.
Yeah, way too many books. Sorry. Well, on a serious note, really, we really could not do this without you, without your support, without your listening, contributing questions and ideas to the program, and also without your pledges. Every year or so, we ask that you cough up something in support of the station, and we're asking you to do that now. We need your help, 217-244-9455 with your pledge.
Programs made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Programming also made possible by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. We'll be back in a little bit. We'll see how many other metaphors we can abuse. Right now, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. Soybeans continue to trade lower, with most contracts near their session lows, while corn is trading about 1 to 2 cents lower as the December contract tests its support at 201 1/4. The wheat market also under pressure today as non-commercial traders continue to sell that particular market. Let's go ahead and look at the current tick for you. December wheat at